Hello, Australia. Who controls your work conditions and your work life? Because I've been reading a lot about Karl Marx recently, and there was really this moment in time where people were unsatisfied with the elite controlling their work lives. And then we had the rise of unionism, and we had people fighting for workers' rights. And then a lot of us became self-employed, masters of our own destiny. We can control who we work for, when we work for, whether we succeed or whether we fail. But it seems to me, at least in some places around the world, there is an attack on your ability to determine your work life. So today we are speaking with Ken Phillips from Self-Employed Australia. And Ken, why? I mean, welcome back. You're here on many of our shows, but you're so excited to be here today. I texted you this morning to make sure that we're still on. You're like, damn well, I'm still going to be there. Why are you so passionate about today?
Well, it's not often that I get the opportunity to, and thank you very much, to sort of carry on about what is my passion. And this has been something I've really been into for 30 years. You know, I've got this book here and I've spent 8 damn years writing it.
Which is Independence and the Death of Employment. This is interesting to me because what do you think about my intro? I've noticed that maybe we're swinging back towards not the same thing as a horrible slave master making the people work in poor conditions, but we are moving back towards a more centrally controlled dictatorial structure in terms of work life. And they're de-incentivizing our ability to control our own work destinies.
Well, there was an article 2 days ago in The Telegraph in the UK, one of the big newspapers in the UK, saying that the UK self-employed has dropped by 500,000 people over the last 12 months. The surge in the economy in the UK over the last several years has been driven by a surge in self-employment, and that it's under so much pressure and intense suppression at the moment that this particular article by an economist was saying that the UK economy will not recover until they do something about the self-employed sector and release it again. So it's the heartbeat and the driver. You know, we talk of entrepreneurship and all that sort of stuff, and we talk of small business being the sort of engine room of the economy. You know, I hate the phrase. It's just ridiculous.
Why? It's true.
Well,
less so.
There's lots of things that are the engine rooms of the economy, and I look at it all in a quite different way. Mm. It's the enabler of the genuine economic self-actualization. You know, if I can get into all this.
Wow, what does that mean?
Well, I was saying to you before we started here that you had this discussion on ethics a while ago, and there was a whole lot of stuff running past me that I wasn't familiar with.
It's a very good town hall. If you want to learn about ethics and what they really mean and how to come up with your ethical frameworks, you should buy this town hall. Link is in the description.
And it was a fascinating discussion. Mm. And in a lot of respects, what I'm on about is really the same thing, but in a different pocket. And so let me take, if I can then, let me take a big step back. And I asked you how long we've got here, and you said, how long do I want? So you should never say that to me.
It's a life's work. So I imagine a couple of hours we need to get through this. Everybody.
So let's take a big step back, and you just talked about Marx and so forth.
Yeah.
There are nice sides and dark sides to us as humans.
Yes.
And the nice side of us is that we have good relationships, we respect each other, we're kind and we're good to each other, and we have a relationship. Mm. And it's a productive relationship. The dark side to our humanity is that there are these urges within us to control other people. Mm-hmm. So it's an urge that says, look, I am good, I am better. And this is not even an urge which is criminal. This is just these, you know, we get those sort of criminal things that go off to one side of the human personality. But we have a tendency to say, look, I'm good, I know what should be done, and everyone should be doing what I say.
Right, that exists on all sides of an argument. My way of government, or my way of whatever it is the right way. Yeah, okay.
And in a democracy, we're in the business of this terribly complicated process of saying, well, how do we resolve all of that?
Yes. You know,
and the debates that are occurring at the moment around politics, wokeism, wokeism is one of those things that says, look, we all have to be nice to each other.
Yes.
But if you disagree with the way we should be nice, I'll rip your throat out.
Right? It's so true.
That's what goes on. Mm. And this happens all through our history. You know, the Greeks, whatever, and you talked about Marx, and it's the same thing. Mm. And, you know, Marxism, for all of its, the dear old Karl Marx, the only reason he succeeded was because he had someone bankrolling him the whole time. You know, Engels. Engels paid.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Engels was a rich industrialist who bankrolled Karl Marx. That's how Karl Marx survived.
I'm okay with that because, I mean, it was just a criticism of the capitalist structure of his day. I'm okay with that. Criticise away.
Yeah. So what we have evolved in our democratic societies is this terribly complicated process that we go through in resolving the problem between, well, look, how do we relate to each other and respectful and so forth, and the dark side of, well, how do we control? And what is, and control is necessary because as a society, we have to get ourselves organised and there have to be ways of making sure things happen properly and control's important and all the rest. So we've got this constant struggle on all of that sort of stuff. And that's part of, and that's what democracy's about. What happens then is that there's an economic aspect to that. And the economic aspect is tied into the nature of contract. That's what I'm into. It's that part of our society that just fascinates me and I'm terribly interested in. So what we have is a situation like, we came here today. So what is a contract?
Yeah.
And we engage in contract every minute of every day. We're doing it all the time, and even though we don't know, we do.
I feel like I'm back in law school.
Yeah. It's pretty simple stuff.
It's just promises.
Well, and consider, so you contacted me, said, look, come along and have a chat. So I come along and have a chat, and we have a relationship. We're having a talk.
Yes.
Right? Respectful talk.
Yes. For now.
For now, right, until we disagree. And then I'll rip your throat out, you know. But if you'd contacted me and said, look, Ken, come along and we'll have a talk and I'll pay you a dollar. Different thing.
Has some consideration now.
Now we've got consideration. So consideration is normally money, but it can be other things. Mm-hmm. So I come along, I say, yes, I'll come along and I'll have a dollar. And I come along and we have our discussion, and at the end of it, you give me a dollar.
Yes.
We have both parties, you've offered me a contract.
Yes.
I've considered the contract.
Yeah.
I've come and fulfilled my part and you've given me the money for the contract.
Yep. Right. Yep.
If you don't give me the money, we then have a dispute.
Mm-hmm.
You say, look, it was a bloody terrible interview. It was boring. So I'm not going to pay you. And so then we've got a dispute.
Sure.
So that's the normal contract. Every time we buy milk at the supermarket, we're entering a contract and we don't even think about it.
Yes.
Now, that contract is the most marvellous thing. So I was a retailer for 20 years. I've got to say, thank God I'm out of it. Because it's.
What did you have? Because you've mentioned this many times. I've known you for a year or two.
Yeah.
Did you have a shop? Or
I had video libraries when video libraries were made.
Like Video Easy, Blockbuster.
That sort of stuff, yeah. Right. I was in a coffee shop.
Okay,
a variety of things. And so I've spent a lot of time sitting behind a counter serving customers. And so every time you're doing that, you're engaging in a commercial contract. And there's a marvellous thing about that, because someone comes into the shop, I don't have to like them. I don't have to know them. I'm not concerned about the colour of their skin or their ethnicity or their background. If they're respectful to me, my task is to be respectful back.
Or respect is not strictly necessary. either in a transaction.
When I say respectful behavior, if someone walks into the shop and they're drunk as a skunk, right, I say, out of the shop.
Okay.
Because their behavior is not respectful within the shop.
But if but in terms of contract, he could be disrespectful walking and say, give me some cigarettes, all here's that 50
sort of,
bucks.
All of this sort of stuff. Yeah. As long as they're not violent all those sorts of things. So in actual fact, that contract which we engage in all the time is colorblind, ethnic blind, historically blind, etc., etc. It's an incredible thing. And we engage in that on a daily basis. And it's
how can you say it's blind, though? We still apply judgments to whether we shop there or not, or whether we like that man serving or not, or
that's offer and acceptance of contract.
Okay, but it's not blind.
Yes, it is, but it's blind in terms of the way it operates. It's not blind in terms of the choices that we make.
Yes.
Right? I want that ice cream, but I don't like that ice cream.
Yes.
Right? So we're making choices.
Yes.
But the nature of the contract itself is blind.
Oh, okay. You pay the money, you get the good.
You get the goods. Okay. The nature of the relationship is blind. We don't have to like each other to engage in it.
Okay.
We don't have to agree with each other. We don't have to have the same political view. We don't have to look the same. We don't have to dress the same. You know, there's no conformity required. It's a transaction which is emotionally blind, racially blind, etc., etc. It's a fabulous thing because it's in actual fact a glue that holds us together as a society.
Mutual trade benefit contracts.
And we'll do business with whoever we want to. That thing is called a commercial contract.
Yes.
And we're all very familiar with it. There are other forms of contract that we have in society. You know, we have a marriage contract, different type of contract. The other dominant economic contract is the employment contract.
Yes.
And the staggering thing about the employment contract is that it's not blind. Because what the employment contract says is that the employer has the right to control you.
Yes.
In the commercial contract, neither party controls the other.
Ah, I see what you mean.
Right, we both come together, we both agree what we want to do once we've ended the contract.
No, but that's the same thing. I used to work for Yamaha, so I read the terms of their offer of employment, and then I signed up and accepted the terms of that contract.
And what you've accepted is that you'll go into a contractual arrangement in which one person has the right to control you.
Yes, and I allowed that.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Right. Once you're in that contract,
yes,
they tell you what time to come to work.
That's right.
When you can take your holidays.
Yeah.
Da 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 da.
Where to sit. Thanks, Yamaha.
You know. And we all accept that.
That's employment. Yeah, I got a job.
That's what employment is, and someone else controls me.
And they give me money.
They give me money.
That's the...
Right? Mm. They're buying my soul.
Go on. They're buying my soul.
Well, they are.
They are. No. Yamaha was tough.
And and what happens there in terms of the theory of the firm, right? There was a fellow who won a Nobel Prize in 1939 for writing the theory of the firm, Ronald Coase.
Okay.
And that's the theory that continues today. Effectively, what they're doing is you go and work for them under this right to control contract, and what they're doing is they're buying your IP, your that's intellectual right. property.
That's in all of our contracts.
Everything that is created, and they own it.
Yes.
Right? So what they're doing, they're extracting the economic benefit that you create and holding it within the firm.
This is why I talk about Marx. This is what he talked about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Marx, in actual fact, was talking about the employment contract and how we have to control the employment contract.
Mm.
And I agree with him.
Mm.
Right? And we've got all this stuff that's established, you know, piles and piles of regulation that say how we control this contract, because it's got all sorts of downsides. It's this control situation. So we have all sorts of human resources management and theory and all the rest. For me, okay, I'm not interested in that.
You're self-employed.
I'm not in the business of being controlled by someone. This is what I like. I like the commercial contract. But I reckon it's a
what
much
about
better
when,
way.
When you have staff, you could put them on as an employee and you become the bourgeois.
I'd become the employer, but I don't do that.
You do contractor relationships.
It's all contractor relationships.
Which is under attack, which I'm sure we'll get to
later. So where I'm at on all of this, and it's funny, I was at one stage a union official. I was a union official
for 8 years.
I can't
believe you were a union official, of all people. Okay.
While I was running, I was running my businesses, my retail business, and I was also a union official doing contract union.
Standover tactics. Because my wife used to work in hospitality down at the docks in Sydney, in Port Botany, and she said the union, she's just this little Swedish girl, and she said the unions would come in, and they'd be so intimidating, really aggressive, trying to force them to do stuff. Yeah. And I said, really? In 2015?
Yeah.
Going on.
Hasn't changed. So That whole contract, the employment contract, I think stinks. But our society, in terms of the firm and particularly government, is structured around the employment contract. And that's where all the control issues come in.
Hang on. First of all, why does it... Stinks for who? Stinks for the worker?
It stinks for me.
Stinks for the employer?
Well, my personal choice, I think. Choice.
And what do you mean, what's the government got to do with...
Well, the whole bureaucracies, everyone who works, every teacher's an employee.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's employed. All
government, public service.
All the public servants are employees.
Yes, okay.
And the employer is this thing called government.
Yes.
And you can never, ever identify.
No.
Is it a single person who's the controller?
Never.
It's a system.
It doesn't really exist, but yet it does.
It does.
Weird.
And it's this whole thing. Now, If you want a process which will be exploitative, look at the public service. It exploits the workers.
Really? Pays them a lot of money.
Pays them a whole lot of money. But, if you have a dispute inside there, you're required to do what you do, and you're told when to do this and told when to do that, and the hierarchical process, and, it's fiefdoms, and it's politics, and on and on it goes. So for me, my choice in life is I find all of that, I really just don't like it. Right? So I've chosen the other path. I work under the commercial contract. And I find that offer an acceptance of contract and you can organise things and you get stuff done and it's very efficient.
Mm.
And you get out there and do it. And the thing is that 17% of the Australian workforce does what I do.
17%.
2.3 million people.
So that means 83% operate in this horrible contract you've described.
So that's what I'm on about. And I'm on about defending the right of people to run their income earning process through the commercial contract.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, for me, that's what my choice.
Yes.
Employment, I recognise what it does and I've written about it and so forth and the control of the firm and so on and so forth. And that's the way it happens. I don't like it, but there's a choice. You can have the choice.
Less so nowadays.
Well, and so what's occurring is the attempts to destroy the choice and whittling that away. And it's the demonisation of self-employment, which at the end of the day is the demonisation of the commercial contract, which is the demonisation of a market economy, which is a demonisation of the economic aspect of our democracy.
Okay, so can we explore why... All right, let's start with COVID. So obviously COVID's smashing small businesses disproportionately. Amazon goes up, for example, but it's long before COVID. You're talking about your life's work here, right?
Yeah.
So what is this trend? What do you mean it's trying to smash down the...
Well, the funny thing in all of this is that the commercial contract in the employment sphere is in actual fact as much a threat to large business as it is to the union movement. So look at it this way. The union movement requires people to be working in a controlled employment relationship.
Mm.
That's the business model.
Mm.
And they need people working in that, because then they can say, look, you're being exploited. There's all these issues. We need to regulate it. We need to control it. We're the unions. Mm. We can control. And so they need people working in that space.
They're a solution looking for a problem in that sense, because a union doesn't help me as a self-employed person.
No. So they don't like people being self-employed. Now, I can have this discussion with people in the union movement, and they understand exactly what I'm talking about. We're on the same page. You know, we understand the debate, because they understand their business model really well. It's the old story of if you don't have an exploited class, you don't have anything to worry about. So you've always got to have, and if you don't have an exploited class, you need to invent it. So it's always, it's the need to maintain at least the impression of exploitation to be able to argue that you need all these control systems in place.
So you, as a union, you don't want to be too successful and make jobs a utopia for your members, because then you've got no purpose anymore.
I just had a discussion with someone the other day who was in a particular area of the workforce where I've put in submissions and the aged care area. There's a whole discussion going on at the Productivity Commission about the banning of self-employed people working in the aged care sector.
What? Why would they ban that?
Well, exactly.
For our safety, right? I'm sure.
And one of the people I was talking to was involved in the debate. They said, yeah, but don't unions want to push the wages up? I said, well, they don't care what people get paid.
Yeah.
It's to their advantage to continue to have an exploited class, even though they'll deny that.
So that means there's an incentive for the head of a union and the head of an exploitative business or government to get together behind closed doors and come up with a theatre. I'll fight you, you fight me, we'll give them a little bit but not too much, and we'll continue this theatre and we'll both benefit.
And that's institutionalised. That's what the Industrial Relations Commission's all about, because it's the stage upon which the theatre's played out.
But it's so convincing, Ken, when I see in the media Alan Joyce being an absolute dickhead to his staff, right, over the past 15, 10 years.
Yeah.
And you just think, damn it, we need the unions to come in and fight this bastard. So I find it hard to think, actually, they're kind of on the same page.
Because they're on the same page.
Okay.
Of course they're on the same page. Why do you think they get together and have, what do you think the wages summit or whatever they're going to have, you know, is all about? It's about the big end of town getting together with big government and big unions to control how our society operates. That's fine. That's democracy. That's the way it works.
It's not democracy. We don't have a choice in that.
Well, it is, because, you know, the majority rules and you get an election and you have the parliament and you get what you're after and so forth.
All right.
And that's the reality. It's not a reality that I'm particularly interested in. And so, you have to live with reality, and you know, democracy is about, if you can't count, don't get involved in the debate.
Mm.
But what I keep saying is, look, there's this bit over here, which I think is fantastic.
17%, yep.
I love it. I'm part of it.
Mm.
And I want to protect it. I want to look after it. For all those reasons I've just discussed, it's the economic and income earning aspect of our democracy and our freedoms and our choices. And it's very real.
It's more than that though, Ken. If we lose that 17% and we all go end up work for Daniel Andrews or Amazon, right? We're going to end up, or Alan Joyce, where you lose...
It's called Huber or the USSR.
Yeah, but you lose innovation, you lose new inventions. I mean, not all. We have the CSIRO, blah, blah, blah. But you're going to be a bunch of, army autonomous workers in an ant
1984.
Colony. Oh, okay, that's what he lays out.
Yeah.
It's a dystopian future, yeah.
Yeah. And this is the self-employed sector is sort of the pressure cooker release valve.
For what?
Well, you have the pressure cooker release valve in terms of a controlled society, right? And it breaks away from that. And
for people to go to when they're frustrated.
Yeah, and move away from it. You know, you can move backwards and forwards. Look, I've got a mate who's worked in the education department.
Yeah.
and IT stuff. And he didn't want to get vaccinated, so he got the flick. And he's now, he's gone to the other side.
Self-employed?
Self-employed. Flat chat. Absolutely run off his feet.
Wow.
Best thing that ever happened. Thank you very much for vaccination mandates.
Oh, wow.
Because he is just busy as.
Okay.
Yeah. He's moved across. Where do you get security of employment? I'll tell you what, if it's security of work, if I've got a dozen clients and I'm self-employed, I've got much more security over my income by having a dozen different clients than I have working for one.
Because one drops, you've got 11.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got all the others sitting there.
But if your boss fires you, you're screwed, yeah.
Yeah, you're then out and what am I doing, where am I going and all the rest, yeah.
So is this ratio normal or even desirable to have such a low release valve? Or do we want most of society, because the voluntarianism and the anarcho-capitalists and the libertarians, they imagine a utopia where everyone's operating on this commercial contract.
Do they? I'm not sure. I don't know if they ever express it that way, do they?
Yeah, they do. So everything becomes a voluntary contract, and most of us are doing business type relationships, so maybe 70-80%, and then a very small but necessary public service type employment exists, but it's all about free exchange of contract.
Well, look, yeah, my book, I call it Independence and the Death of and the Death of Employment. It's sort of a cheeky title. I'm not predicting what's happening, and I'm all. You've got to maintain the choice between the two. There are circumstances in which the large command and control organisation works.
Objectively and works, or have our people been trained for that? Because that's what I see. Our whole schooling system, everything I went through was trained to push me into working for Yamaha.
I was a primary school teacher.
Yeah, it was your fault. You were doing it to us.
And, you know, it's just a factory.
Yeah.
That's all it is. Keen on homeschooling and all those sorts of things, if you can cope with it, for sure. But, you know, this is the way our society goes and all the rest, and you live with what you've got. So what I do is I just focus on let's maintain the choice. So there are a number of things that have gone on here. For a long, long time, the demonisation of self-employment really sort of started to kick up in the 1970s. So understand our more recent sort of history over the last century. We had two world wars. And essentially, a world war is about the galvanizing of the entire society under a command and control system the purposes of killing the other side.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so I'm just reading at the moment the history of General Motors.
Yes.
And part of the history of General Motors is how General Motors was able to mobilize during the Second World War from like nothing to becoming a massive war machine, a war production machine.
Right.
And General Motors was perfectly suited for that, so large organisation. So what you have is, during that period, you've got to remember that the world wars were fought by mainly men who were in their 20s.
Yes.
And so they were trained in a command and control system. So what we had coming out of the World War was a whole body of very professional people who were command and control systems people. And so you had Alfred P. Sloan from General Motors, and then you had Drucker and so forth who put all these sorts of management theories in place.
Oh, it's the other studio. I've got Drucker's books. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yep.
And then we then started to have a shift out of that, because that command and control system works to, in terms of entrepreneurship and innovation, works to a certain point. It gets to a point where it just starts to ossify.
Yes, that's
and true. And so then you get all the breakaways happening.
In the 50s, late 50s?
Through the boom. Really, it was in sort of the 60s, the flower power generation. It was all of that. It was all interconnected.
Yeah, of course.
And so you started to really find that the command and control firm sort of reaches it's a point of where it's just struggling to innovate.
In the 50s, yeah.
And something else comes along and starts to kick up and so forth. And
60s,
so you get disruptive industries and ideas and everything coming out. You know, the McDonald's was a disruptive industry. The whole idea in retailing originally, you know, product used to be behind the counter.
Yep.
The idea of putting product out where the customer could touch the product and steal it was a retail revolution.
Okay.
You know, GJ Coles in Australia was the revolutionary in revolutionary retailer. So you had this movement, and out of that started rising up during the 70s and into the 80s, the percentage of people who were self-employed started to rise. Now, since then, there's been a big debate about whether this is good or bad, because what it does is threatens the business model of the union movement and the business model of the large firm, the command and control firm. So you have this intellectual debate around, and you'll find this debate really strongest in the Labor left lawyer movement.
Okay.
So, and then it all relates around the tax issue. I hope I'm not boring people too much.
So in the 70s, I'm curious, that might help. In the 70s, this debate starts, but then you'd have resistance coming from the big firms and those sort of people to stop the rise of self-employment. As an aside, is that not simply a return to what it was before the rise of the big firms? If you go back even pre-Marx, when you had it, even right back to barter and the evolution of just independent contracts before big firms existed, then big firms came along and we all got into this thing, and now we're kind of returning back to a more open, voluntary system.
Yeah, so you even go back to that period of where the spinning wheel came in. You know, and what that was doing was putting all of the home spinners of the Highlands of Scotland and everything out of business.
Mm.
And there was all that people were, you know, coming in and destroying the manufacturing sites and all the revolutions and riots that happened around all of that. It's the same
Luddites, thing.
So to some extent, what we've got is a mix, really, mix. So there are a couple of things that then occurred. So the PAYE tax system.
Oh, that's the worst thing in the world.
Right. That was invented.
When?
Between the First and the Second World War. And it was invented primarily as a funding mechanism for the Second World War.
So give us your...
So the First World War was funded on debt.
You're talking about... just tax, not necessarily just PAYG. Tax.
No, I'm talking about the PAY, employment tax, right? Or income tax.
Income tax.
And, but it was administered through what then was the PAYE system. So the First World War was funded on debt.
And there was almost no income tax, very minimal.
Second World War, in particular in the US, income tax to fund the Second World War.
How are they earning money before people don't really... They say, oh, we have to pay tax because how do we have roads and hospitals? We had roads and hospitals before this. How? Do you know, how was the government...
Oh, there's
money?
A whole variety. Tariffs were a big one. Okay. Tariffs were huge.
So that's like a GST type thing.
Well, no. Well, in other words, if you're importing goods, there were tariffs on there was a tax. And so this is...
Yeah, but it's connected to action. Earnings. Yeah.
Not to earnings.
Yeah, okay.
So
tax comes in for World War II.
So income tax then was structured around, because you had 90% of the workforce, 95% of the workforce were employees post-Second World War. The PAYE system, which is the administration of the collection of income tax.
They take it out each pay.
Each pay. But the tax authority's power to do that under legislation is exclusively tied to the employment relationship.
Of course, which is the case today.
No, it's not.
We don't have PAYG.
So what happened during the 70s and the 80s and into the 90s, the taxation system was screaming and trying to kill off independent contracting, and it's happening in the UK at the moment.
Because there's no...
They didn't have the legislative power to collect tax from self-employed people.
But they do collect on the income of our companies.
It's different. I'll talk about 2000. Right? So they didn't have that legislative power.
Okay.
So there was this huge debate about how evil self-employment was during the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. One of the reasons being because it prevented the ATO from legally collecting income tax.
Mm.
2000 came along, and one of the great revolutions that occurred in Australia in the tax administration of the tax system under the under Costello was not just the GST, but they changed the whole tax collection system, the legislation, from PAYE to PAYG.
Please explain this.
So what you now have under the legislation, I hope again I'm not boring people, but what you have now under the legislation is the tax commissioner has the power to collect income tax if you're an employee.
Yes.
And they collect it from the employer.
They had that before 2000 as well.
That's the same, same thing, right? And if you're self-employed, the tax commissioner has the power to collect income tax from you, which is the BAS system, which you fill out your BAS form.
Yeah, that's GST. That's not tax.
Do you do? Depends on which system you're under, but you put in your IAS form every year or every quarter.
Oh, I'm a company. Maybe that's the difference.
Yeah, but because you're a company, you're an employee of the company, so captured under that leg.
Yeah, I get that.
Right. If you're not a company, and two-thirds of people who are self-employed are individuals. They're not a company.
Okay.
So they would
pre-2000, those people, the tradie who's self-employed, didn't pay tax?
No, they'd have to get pay tax at the end of the year, but the tax commissioner couldn't collect it through the year.
Oh, okay. So they assess it at the end like we do as a company and pay it.
Yeah.
And when the government didn't like that, why?
Because they don't get their cash flow.
They wanted cash earlier.
Okay. Yeah, they want the cash flow.
And so 2000 comes and now you have to pay installments like the PAYG employee sheet.
PAYG, whether you're an employee or a contractor or you're a contractor through a labour hire company, they've got these three legislative legs that enable them to administer the tax system.
And so when you get to the end of the year, people, and say the government's giving me $2,000 as a bonus, you idiots.
Yeah.
Sorry to be so mean about it, but you've got to understand. They're giving you your own damn money back.
So I was part of the push around the PAYG stuff. The reason being, I wanted to get the tax administration system being able to collect tax from the self-employed people because that meant that we'd be able to exist. I wanted to remove that legislative block, that administrative and institutional block.
You wanted the PAYG system to come
out? Yeah.
Why? It's better. I'd rather pay tax at the end of the year.
No, because what we had is the taxation system, the taxation office, screaming about they couldn't collect the tax. And so they were in bed with the union movement to kill us off. So I needed to institutionally get rid of the problem.
Okay, and then they stop attacking. But that hasn't happened. They're still attacking.
No, different reasons.
Right,
okay. They can't attack on that reason.
Okay.
They'll attack for other reasons. Okay. So that was the first thing that went on there. And so what I've been looking for, all of my sort of this love job stuff that I do, how do we institutionally change the situation to neuter the opposition to self-employment and enable it to go ahead?
I see what you're doing. Yeah.
It's been a long, this has been 30 years.
But you can't, I understand what you're doing, strategic, but also you can't just make it so similar and bad for self-employment to look like employment so the government doesn't attack us.
Well, here's the thing. And let's look at a social administrative sense, right? We have to have government, whether we like it or not. I think it should be as small as you can, but we have government. So how's the tax system collected? Well, you want tax to be able to collect it so it can be done properly. You don't want to have a fight over that. And the issue, and this is the problem they've got in the UK, I've got to say, the issue about income tax, if you're going to have it and you can agree with it as a good system or a bad system, doesn't matter. But from my angle, what I'm saying is that the issue is not whether you're an employee. The issue needs to be whether you're an income earner. So if you're going to have income tax, the policy that you need to have in place reflected in the legislation is that it is someone who is earning an income that pays the tax, whether you agree with the tax or not.
That's always I don't understand how that's not always the case.
Well, it hasn't been the case because what you've done is through the administrative system, because government wants its cash flow, they only had cash flow control over employees, not over self-employed.
Yes. Mm?
So these things might seem like terribly simple and sort of, why am I bothering about it? But it's there's a long-term objective here. So let me take it. So through all that sort of debate, I've been banging on this, and I think I'm sort of, in Australia anyway, getting somewhere with it slowly. So for example, the International Labour Organization, division of the United Nations, has an income budget each year of about $1 billion.
That place is such a grift.
So every year, so the ILO, the International Labour Organization, is sort of the high church of labour law, yeah, across the world, right? And every year, you have representatives of government, unions, and employees or employers getting together in Geneva to have a big confab about whatever the particular issue is in labour law at the time. Yeah. Right? 3-week discussion group.
Eating caviar and, yeah, okay.
But it matters, because what they say has influence about our laws. Mm. So in 2003, and I went back again in 2006, I wound up going over there, because for 10 years they've been having the biggest debate ever about whether self-employment was legitimate or not.
It seems so stupid to me, that kind of a debate.
Yeah.
Of course it's legitimate.
Well,
it's how it always was.
No, they were debating whether it was legitimate
or not. They're morons on $1 billion a year.
Yeah. So I went over there, and so you go into this, you know, it's a United Nations type sort of setup.
Was it good food?
400 people, yeah, in the sort of debating about whether self-employment was legitimate or not. I was the only self-employed person there.
Oh, that's ridiculous. Well, they're all employed by United Nations or government or whatever.
They're all government or employers or unions.
Okay.
Right? So I was able to do was run around coffee shops sort of, yeah, lobbying people and talking to them and sitting down and all the rest. The outcome of those two sessions was that the ILO has declared that there are two forms of contract. There's an employment contract.
Yeah.
There's a commercial contract.
Yeah.
Both are legitimate.
Okay.
The ILO has made that declaration.
Yeah, well, they didn't need to. It's like me saying there are two genders.
Well, it was important that they did.
Biology.
2006, I was able to use that to under the Howard government, to push for the Independent Contractors Act. We have an Independent Contractors Act in Australia. As a result of that.
Oh.
That says that the difference between an employee and a contractor is the common law, which is the commercial contract versus the employment contract.
Okay.
It's in statute.
Okay.
Not just what the judges say.
Okay.
Right? So we've got it in statute.
Yep.
So once again, it's sort of things, well, why would you bother doing this? Well, what it says is that Independent Contractors Act is that governments can't override the right to be an independent contractor.
That's good that we have this.
Yes. It's good legislation.
Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah.
So we've got that in place. What it's also done that's important is changing the mindset around how we regulate self-employment, in importantly in Treasury and in the government policy wonk boffin area. Terribly important. So we've had a shift. So there are two examples that I can give where the shift has happened. The first one is in quite specific examples, is in paid parental leave,
yes,
situation. Ordinarily, so we've got Commonwealth funded paid parental leave laws, and so if you're a new parent, you can apply for the paid parental leave through the government system. Ordinarily, that would have been tied exclusively to employment.
Yes, not anymore.
That law came in under the Howard. It was a Howard government initiative. And the primary design of that legislation is not whether you're an employee, but whether you're a parent.
Okay.
Pretty sensible. So under that legislation, it doesn't matter whether you're self-employed or an employee, you're entitled to the paid parental leave benefit. And that was a breakthrough because it showed that Treasury were understanding and the policy people were understanding, hang on a sec, we've got this group of people over there, self-employed, and they're entitled to these things because the policy issue should not be whether you're employed or not, but the what's the objective of the legislation, and the objective
help parents.
Is help parents.
But you're okay, so you're painting a rosy picture now for our treatment of self-employed.
It's improving. So when we had the worker, like when we had JobKeeper come in, and this is a big difference to the UK.
Yeah,
we had JobKeeper come in again. What and full of praise, I've got to say, for the ATO, even though I have a lot of criticism of the ATO, but on this issue, it was bloody good. Because what they said was, the policy intent here is not whether you're employed or not, but whether you're out of work.
Okay.
So the JobKeeper system had two primary legs to it. A system to administer the payment through the employer, if you're an employee.
Or self-employed.
Or if you're self-employed, the system came, the payment came direct to you.
Yes.
Right? Pah! Exactly what we want. Because the issue is not whether or not you're an employee. The issue is whether or not you were with work or not, had work or not, whether you had your income or not. So we've had some substantial successes. In the UK, the only people who got the job benefit in the UK during the COVID stuff were employees, all self-employed.
Oh, really?
They suffered. Dropped. Bang.
This is disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it might seem that, you know, and I'd sort of take quiet satisfaction in this because I've got a clear vision of where we have to go with it. And I've been lucky enough that under various governments that they've you know, banged on, and somehow or other I think I've got through, and I'm not, you know, no one does anything on your own, but I've been banging on this. And that this is what it should be. What we should be looking at in terms of this regulation environment is what's the policy objective? Are you a parent? Do you not have an income? Whatever it is. Same goes with occupational health and safety, so on and so forth. So we've moved now in that direction, and we've got some good stuff happening. I've got an article sitting out there waiting to be published. We've got the unfair contract clause, and I lobbied for 7 years to get those, and we got them in place. And it's quite clear I wouldn't have got those if I hadn't done, and Self-Employed Australia hadn't done the work. It's terribly important because understand form contracts, both consumers and self-employed people get screwed over by big business. Right? So these laws are simply saying, well, look, no, you can't do that. There are certain cutoff points. You know, very simply, you can't change the terms of the contract unless the other party agrees. Well, duh. But big business were routinely, and they still do, write contracts that enable them to change the terms of the contract without reference to the other party.
Yes, all the time, yeah.
So we've needed to beef those laws up. There was legislation in place just before the election. Morrison government didn't go through with it. I don't know why. They didn't push them through. And the Albanese government has just declared that they're going to, last week they announced they're going to push these through this term.
The good laws that you just talked about?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Done.
Full of praise for them. Fantastic.
Okay.
So even in the Labor Party see a tremendous amount of this is good stuff.
Yeah.
Right. I've got a big push for security payment laws. The worst thing that happens for small business is that you don't get paid on time, et cetera, et cetera. So all of that's good stuff. And I hope, and I want us to keep going in those sorts of directions. However, and this was the article that you saw that you said come and talk to us. We've now got the Labor Party, and this is coming out of the union movement and so on and so forth, saying we're going to pass laws that say if you're self-employed, we're going to make you a little bit an employee.
How? In what way?
Good question.
Does it say or not?
Well, there's a law in the UK of 1986 that says this. It's a one paragraph in a labour law in the UK that is quite strange, and you could interpret it a dozen different ways, but it was applied fairly recently in the UK to destroy the Uber business model.
They used it to destroy Uber?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So what they've done there is they've said that Uber drivers or rideshare are entitled to some of the benefits
of an employee,
holiday pay, et cetera, et cetera. Now, on the outset, you say, well, look, that all seems terribly fair and reasonable and all the rest. But in actual fact, when you pursue that structure, what you do is you get the employment, the commercial contract, and you say, we're going to treat it as as an employment contract.
And the whole Uber business model falls over.
Business model falls over. What you do is you create a level of confusion in the operation of your economy in this vital area, which just throws the whole thing into chaos. Right? In other words, you don't know if you have a firm contract. You don't know what the nature of the contract is. We can't do this thing of I come in here and you're going to pay me the dollar and then we've got the contract.
Yep.
Right? All of a sudden, you've got a regulator coming in and say, well, look, hang on a second. Instead of paying the dollar, I'm going to require you to withhold 20 cents of the dollar for holiday pay for Ken.
Get stuffed.
Right? And then I'm going to require you to withhold another 5 cents for superannuation or whatever it might. The minute we go down that path, you're throwing the whole thing, throw the whole thing up in the air.
I don't want to employ you. I want to pay you a dollar for appearing, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
So what are they trying to bring this in Australia?
They've committed, the Labor Party have committed to this law.
What does the law actually say in our context?
Well, what they do is they make a statement, motherhood statement, about what they're going to do, and then now let's look at the legislation.
Okay.
We don't know what they haven't said what it'll be. They've made this motherhood statement about the whole thing. And what I know, it has to be stopped. You can't do this.
Because it will undermine the commercial contract, free contracting.
The key thing about a contract and the key thing about our commercial operations is certainty. Know where we stand.
Yeah.
You know, you make an offer to me, I come in, we do the talk, you pay me a dollar. We know that was the deal.
Yeah.
When government turns around and says, retrospectively, we will revisit the deal and we'll change it, or we might change it, or we don't know, and we'll have a body over there that will try and change the deal that you and I put together, well, then all of a sudden you turn around and you go, Ken, look, you can come and talk to me, but I don't know if I'll pay you a dollar or not.
It depends on what the government's... Now, is this because of the beginning of our conversation, they're just trying to bring self-employed people back under the umbrella of control?
Well, what you've got is particularly your Labor academics and this whole sort of body of thought that essentially what they say is the only legitimate work is employment. That's the view.
What's their argument for that? Safety conditions.
Oh, look, they raise all sorts of stuff all over the place. You know, it goes on and on. You basically go back to Karl Marx.
Oh, that kind of thing.
Right. Okay. It all rolls back to that. And I'm not saying that in terms of Karl Marx to be sort of ideological basher a can about it. But therein is all the, you know, eons and hundreds of books and thousands of, you know, tens of thousands of pages written on all this sort of stuff. So you've got all that sort of thing. It's this whole battle that goes on about, you know, the claim that self-employed are exploited, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Exploited. So yeah. They're victims and this is what helped them.
Yeah. I was involved in an online discussion with a whole lot of people fairly recently and about a particular area of work on this, and once again a debate over whether or not independent contractors should be allowed or not. And what's happening in that sector is that you've got gig economy stuff happening, and the workers are getting paid more than they would be if they were an employee.
Right.
Good thing?
Yeah.
Right. And it's happening because the consumer, or the person that needs to be serviced, is able to offer more money.
Yes.
And so the debate that was occurring with all academics and others, well, but what if the consumer asks the service provider to do some work for nothing?
It's up to them to form a contract or not. It's a market.
Yeah, but they'll be allowing each other to exploit each other.
That's their choice.
But we can't do that. As the regulator, that's not right.
It's none of your business. That's what it is.
Oh.
Someone wants to volunteer for Discernible for a day a week.
No. We can't allow people to exploit each other. We can't allow them the opportunity to potentially exploit each other. We've got to stop it.
This is very patriarchal, very controlling.
Well, it comes to control. Who's going to control the relationship? So this is the equivalent of saying people shouldn't be allowed a choice to buy their own home because they might make a bad choice and they might lose money when the house prices drop, so therefore don't let them buy their own house. We'll have all homes supplied by the state.
But this mentality has been everywhere and on overdrive these past 2 years,
yeah,
that we can't allow you to pollute
make your
yourself
own choice
for your own good. Yeah.
Yes.
So why is it then? How do you explain that the government is doing some good things and some bad things? It's clearly not just a war on the self-employed because they're doing good things at the same time. They're just confused.
Is the lack of focus, lack of understanding.
So we're dealing with incompetence more than malevolence.
Both. You know, it's the old story of bad. You know, quite often the worst things that happen are done by people with the best intent.
Yes. Okay.
So you have all that sort of stuff going on. I had a long discussion with a whole lot of bureaucrats once. I forget whether in the tax area or whatever it was, and these bureaucrats said to me, "We've heard that some people like to be self-employed, that they enjoy it." And I went, "Well, you're looking at one.
2 million of us. What are you talking about?" Yeah, okay.
Like, it just, these people are not that particularly. It was a genuine question.
Hmm.
They can't conceive being self-employed. Yeah.
Can we talk about the mainstream psychology or the mainstream, the culture of this as well? Because we talked about...
Yeah, it's very cultural stuff.
Yeah, we talk about within government houses and within the public service, the boffins and the academia, and they think that way. But that doesn't really scare me. What scares me is that if I have a conversation with the average person up the road or the next door neighbor over here, he's a nice guy, but they have the same mentality. Of course government should do this. Of course. Why would people want to be self-employed? They
very,
somehow...
Very much a cultural thing in Australia. It's quite different in the United States.
Completely different.
You know, there's 45 million people in the United States are self-employed.
45 million?
45 million. We've got 1.2 million. Yeah. Like, it's a much larger percentage. I figure, you know, it's up in the sort of 25, approaching 30%. Some figures are showing it as a third of the workforce.
So did the government cause the Australian culture like this, or is it always, what came first? Do we have a prisoner mentality here from day dot?
Yeah, I remember ages ago, a long time ago, you asked me, well, why the curious thing that Victoria...
Yeah.
Is
prison central
sort of so much sort of socialist? You know, there's a very strong socialist streak in Victoria,
despite the Eureka Stockade.
I said to because of the Eureka Stockade, you have to understand it out of that. You know?
Yeah.
the sort of the Irish thing is a very important part of it. Right? It's the reaction against colonialism, I've got to say, I agree with a tremendous amount of it.
Okay.
And so just the cultural thing built in, you know, there's, you know, a number of politicians refer to Victoria as the Massachusetts of the United States.
What's the reference?
Well, Massachusetts is very socialist in its...
Is it?
Okay. Oh, yeah. It's, you know, Once again, I'm not saying, you know, Massachusetts is a fantastic place. Boston is just brilliant, and what comes out of it and all the rest.
Places are very pretty.
Yeah.
But, public services in Victoria are better than New South Wales. Not public services. Parks and recreation.
Yeah.
There's a lot of money being spent on this place. Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, none of these things are ever black and white.
Yeah.
You know, our debates that go on this sort of stuff, anything that we have on the debate on public policy, on our laws and so forth, even our relationships, it's never a black and white. It's always, you've got a very long piece of string, and where do you choose to tie the knot is what we're always debating.
But back to the question of the culture of, where are we going to go is really what I'm wondering. Is Australia going to head down to that path that you've been fighting?
Mm.
And we all come under and are all employed by a mythical Amazon? Because the culture seems to indicate that less and less people want to be self-employed.
We've got to remember that one of the funny things about Amazon is that so much of it is structured around self-employment.
Okay, bad example. But, you know, I mean, being employed
It's one of the revolutions of Amazon. Amazon is it's a disruptor. It's a retail disruptor, because what it does is it offers self-employed people or people to provide their services onto their platform, which you can sell your service through their platform.
I wasn't referring to that, though, the partners who sell through Amazon. I was referring to people who work for the corporate of Amazon, workers.
Yeah.
Or work for Kmart, or work for government, work for a big organization, or Yamaha. Is that where we're going? What's the trends you've noticed over the past X number of decades working in this?
Well, in Australia, I can talk the UK to start off with. The UK had a big surge, came from about 12% of the workforce up to approaching 15% of the workforce during their boom, their post GFC boom.
Mm-hmm.
Massive. Mm. It's now sliding back because there's a reaction by the tax office in the UK and the unions and all the rest. So you've got a social shift happening there, institutional shift.
Mm.
Right? Here we had a build up of the self-employed during the 1970s, and it hit a peak in the late 1990s of just tickling 19% of the workforce.
19, okay. And we're back to the 13.
And 17, we've pulled back to about 17, and we've been sitting on about 17% of the workforce for about the last 15 years. It's been very stable. And the actual numbers have slightly gone up. So it's 2.1 million people at the moment because the population, the workforce got larger. So it's been quite stable as a percentage of the workforce.
Yeah.
The percentage of people who are casual employees has also been incredibly stable.
Okay.
I think that sits at about 20 or 25% of the workforce.
This is despite all of the noise about casualisation?
It's loads of nonsense.
Really?
The whole thing has been, numbers-wise, super stable for about the last 15-plus years.
Mm.
Hasn't shifted.
And all the academics watching, screaming at their TVs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the but in the process, what's occurred, of course, is that the private sector workforce that is unionised has dropped to about 8 or 9%. You know,
So unions are collapsing.
In the private sector,
doing
quite well in the
public
sector, but of course, what sustains the union movement these days and the Labor Party is not the membership. It's not the membership that's the issue for them. It's the superannuation industry.
They're into big business now.
Yeah. The socialists have become the capitalists.
Yeah, that's obvious around the whole planet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So
where are we going then? Stable?
Well, these sorts of things are always trend backwards and forwards. And my bag is to say, look, let the market prevail. If people want to choose employment, if that's the way it goes, fine. Keep self-employment there. Don't discriminate between the two. Have a neutral process through the whole thing. Have the required protections for independent contractors and self-employed, which is security of payment laws, prevention of unfair contracts. You can go on through those things. People, in actual fact, this is where it sort of things get turned on its head. unions carry on. Well, self-employed people don't have access to collective bargaining. Well, no, you're wrong. They don't have access to collective bargaining under employment law, but they do have access to collective bargaining under ACCC, under competition laws. Mm. So groups of self-employed people, small businesses, can get together to negotiate to collectively buy wholesale goods or whatever it might be. Okay. You can do all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying is we have to respect and protect the status of both. For me, I don't like employment, but that's fine, right? But let us all decide what we want to do. Let the people decide. Don't impose anything. And then in particular, don't turn around and treat one contract as if it's the other. Don't stuff this thing up, because we will do significant damage to our economy if we start playing that sort of game.
So what's the deal? We just have to watch, make sure the Labor Party in Australia does not go ahead and stuff that up.
Yep, that's the objective.
Watch them for 3 years and raise noise if they try.
And lobby on it and keep pushing. That's why I'm delighted to have this conversation here, because I don't know how big your audience is, but to me this is important to understand.
Yeah.
You know, the again, I was having a discussion with someone the other day met them at the function, and they're into the free market and, you know, all the sorts of things that we're into. And they said, well, what are your objectives there? And we talked about it. And they said, so in other words, you want to influence legislation? I said, well, duh.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, that's what we're dealing with. What's the law say? We're in the business of influencing the law. We're in the business of seeking to, and must be, in the business of seeking to influence to go to good law and stop bad law. So what I'm doing at the moment is identifying a threat that's being created around what's going to be really, really bad law. It will do a lot of damage.
Okay.
And this is this swap over thing.
And that's what you wanted to talk about today.
That's it.
It's 1 hour.
It's pretty simple.
I think so. Just keep an eye out for it. Get this book if you're interested. Why would I buy this book? Independence and the Death of Employment. What's it going to do to me?
It's still available, and it just explains all the sorts of stuff that I've just been talking about.
Understanding contracts and... Oh, it does too. I can see that there.
Yeah.
How it exists. All right. Well, I am somehow strangely... I grew up in Australia, and I am more and more... dejected to discover the reality of the Australian culture towards self-employment, free market contract. I don't think I fit in this country. I think America might be better for me.
Look, I'll tell you, I was devastated to find our borders closed.
International borders?
Our state borders.
State borders.
To discover that we are...
That's illegal under the Constitution, right. Anyway.
To discover, and the High Court turns around and says, we apply this precautionary principle, and you go, what are you talking about? You've invented a reason to justify the closing of the borders.
Which is explicitly outlawed in the Constitution.
Yeah, it was just, I found that just a shock to the system. We're not a nation, we're a series of colonies.
Always were. For a brief moment, we had the illusion that we're a federation.
Yeah.
But you know what? More scary than that, than the High Court doing that, is the people.
Supporting us.
Even to this day. We're in 2022, and I've been doing polls. And
Stockholm syndrome.
I always tell you about the polls we do on Discernible, because I get a sample size of maybe 2,000 to 3,000, which is good. And it's biased because it's people who are following my page.
Yeah, I get it.
But still, 2,000 to 3,000, you know, as big as some of these Ray Morgan polls. And the consensus is that most other Australians that we know are valuing comfort, not even valuing fairness anymore, valuing comfort. And not most of them are not waking up to see, wow, this is a bit weird. This is a bit dodgy. This is a bit authoritarian. Most of them are still oblivious. They think this is normal. All the things you've talked about, closing of the borders, anything we might describe as unethical or extraordinary even, they're not picking up on that. They don't even realize what they've been through is at least extraordinarily different to normal. They're just sleepwalking around. I feel like I'm walking in a field of sheep.
Look, we're in a situation where per head of population, I think we're now the wealthiest country in the world.
That explains it.
Explains a lot, yeah. You know, it's one of those situations just that you think of Nazi Germany. How did they get to that point?
And well, not through wealth like us.
No, they got there incrementally. So things just happen a little bit at a time. It's all chipped away. Now, given that also Hitler then progressively murdered off all of his opponents, so we don't do that here.
Right? We do that figuratively speaking.
We do.
In some of our states.
Also the cancelling discussion. It's the killing off of discussion. You know, if you don't, you know, we're going to be nice to each other, and if you don't agree with me, I'll rip your throat out. Right? Mm. So I don't dare express an opinion that's different to what I've got. And these things, you always get to, fortunately, a democracy, you get to a situation where it just happens slice by slice. It's salami stuff. Mm. Right? And then you get to a point, you go, how do we get here? And you don't know because you've already got there.
Will they get to that point is my question, though. Because I'm saying, even now, I thought they'd say, well, how did we get here? This isn't quite what I wanted, but they're not. They're getting there saying, it's okay. I was at Springvale Snow Festival the other day. Mm. Sorry to bring up vaccinations again. But the level of... out in the middle of the festival, packed.
Mm.
No, hardly any masks. You know, it's 80-90% of us not wearing masks. Packed shoulder to shoulder in this festival. And Springvale's not the cleanest place. You know, there's a kind of a grunginess to it, which I like. I'm from Cabramatta in Sydney, so that's all good. But the point is, it's not that hygienic in one sense. And then
it's very much the heartbeat of Asia in Melbourne.
Yeah, it was fun. It was good food. And then in the middle of, it was good for my immune system. In the middle of it, there's these vaccination tents. And somehow within that crowd, there are these really nervous, tightly masked people who somehow appear out of the crowd and approach this desk to get their boosters. It was just free boosters, which are not mandated. So if you're getting a booster now at a festival with your kids for snow, like there's a certain element of buy-in to that. And if you want to buy, you have 10 boosters, that's fine, get them. But I just feel like I'm not sure where people were ever actually asked that question that you said, how did we get here? Some people are happy to stumble down the hill into a new reality, whatever that reality is, and never question it.
You mentioned vaccination. I just had my fourth. Right.
Congratulations.
Yes. And, you know, I'm one of those people.
Your second head growing?
Yeah. I'm one of those people. If there's a vaccination, you know, I'll stick you with something which will stop something. I'll be in it. Right. But boy, am I against mandates. Right. The enforcement of that I'm dead against, right? So if it's your choice, your body, your choice, right?
It doesn't matter about
the mandates that's the issue.
But let's talk about questioning it, though.
Hmm.
At what point would you, well, let me know if you don't want to talk about this, but at what point would you say, I don't know if I want to have one every 3 months? Because every 3 months we have to have them now, right?
Well, I'm not sure what's going on. Like, there's stuff that I know that I'm good at, which is this stuff, right? And there's stuff that I know that I really don't know what's going on.
So you defer to the experts, right?
I throw my hand. You know, if I'm going to a place, you know, travelling to a place that's got cholera rife, I'll say, can I get an injection for cholera beforehand?
Sure.
Or typhoid or whatever it is.
So maybe that's what is going on with employment law and so on. Australians just aren't engaged, so they defer to the experts.
Look, one of the probably for me on this front, understand, when I was a kid in measles was just rife, right? There were all sorts of bloody horrible diseases running around that were killing kids off the whole time. And
not anymore.
Yeah. And we were all getting injected and all this sort of stuff. And all those, and as kids, we didn't get it. But I remember the absolute terror and fear of before all of this sort of stuff came in about our kids were going to die, and it was real.
Of measles and so on.
All that stuff.
Oh, of course, of course. Right? Yeah, yeah.
And so for me, all the injections and the vaccinations and all the rest have enabled me from a child of two or three to come through to my age of 67, really pretty much healthy and disease free from things that not that long ago were killing people off. So I've probably got a more of a trust in the system from that aspect because of my life experience. Whereas I think people who, we don't vaccinate anymore for measles or whatever it might be.
Really? We did when I went through.
Yeah, there are a number of the diseases that have been eliminated basically that we don't vaccinate anymore for children. Because we don't need to.
They're putting the vaccination aside because it's not really what I'm talking about. I'm just saying the idea. So in this case, you're deferring to the experts for that, which
because of my life experience, perhaps. Yeah.
But are Australians, maybe that's what we're discussing. Maybe that's why they're drawn to employment contracts and they're drawn to just whatever the government kind of says, this is the best way to do it.
And there's a lot of the history behind it. You I agree with you. The United States is vastly more robust democracy than we are, vastly more robust because it's intensely self-questioning.
We don't. Yeah.
We tend not to, and I think that probably a big part of that is we're one of the few nations in the world that's come together without coming together through war. The United States was born out of war. And everyone's had to fight, and it's the number of wars that the United States has had internally. It's just been, it's not just the Civil War and the one, it was the Mexican War and et cetera, et cetera. It's a nation created out of violence.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a culturally inbuilt thing that says, well, look, I don't trust government because they'll, necessarily and so forth and. So that's a culturally different environment, and I've got to protect. This is what's behind the gun stuff. I've got to protect myself. I can't wait for someone else. I remember having a discussion with someone in the United States. Been there a number of times, and we were talking about the gun laws, and they said to me, "Ken, look, if I ring the police,
20 minutes, if at all,
20 minutes, 2 or 3 hours,
well, hours. Okay, right? So I need to protect.
Or
my
if
family.
They come, so I've got to have guns." You go, all right, different concepts thing. Sitting there.
Yeah.
You don't trust the system to work for you.
But the laws back that up there. You can defend your castle. Here you can't.
Yeah.
You shoot someone with your hunting rifle, you still end up in the dock.
Yeah. So, no, we have all these, what we thought were freedoms and protections and all the rest in our society, and yet I'm in agreement with you. I think that we lose a sense of what we had and understanding what we have or should have, and we get confused and lethargic about it and being wealthy is part of that process.
Well, New Zealand, it scares me a lot. If you look at the way they've accepted what's going on over there, I wonder if Australia's going to just head that way. But you know what? I was reading a thing about when we...
just on the New Zealand thing. Yeah. New Zealand flicks backwards and forwards in a very big way,
You reckon?
Oh, yeah. The National Party that was in during the 50s and so forth.
Oh, that's
was,
a long time ago. I'm thinking 80s onwards.
Even then they were, it was agrarian socialism to the nth degree.
Right.
Then you had sort of this change over where you had a Labor Party that became one of the most rabid free market sort of countries in the world. It was a leader in economic reform, and it led Australia to an enormous extent.
That's in the 70s.
Lange government, was it the Lange government? And then it swings back the other way, and then the Labor Party sort of started to go pretty socialist again.
Hardcore. Since the 80s, it's felt a bit...
Yeah, so New Zealand's got quite a habit of doing these quite wild swings, much more than we have here.
Well, broader question. I've been reading about how, as humans evolved or grew up in societies, we relate to our tribe of sort of 80, 100, 120 max. That's how we kind of, before social media and internet and all this, that's kind of how we imagine ourselves. We locate ourselves within groups. We don't imagine ourselves within 20 million. It doesn't work. And so I'm wondering if people who are fighting for their countries, like in the US, the right wing's fighting to maintain certain things about America, and the left wing's fighting to progress it and fix it. And here in Australia, you got the Greens are fighting this. What, maybe we don't need to fight for the whole country. Can't we just be happy in a much smaller group and a much smaller tribe? So you said 17% of people are self-employed. That's a huge number.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't matter that 80% of the country want to go live like that.
Yeah.
We can live a quite happy life in our tribe over here of a million people.
And, you know, the lucky country, there's very few occasions where we actually are physically threatened as a nation. Even now, you know, the whole Ukraine situation, all of a sudden it's changed the politics of Europe just on its head.
Mm,
flipped it completely. Yeah. All of a sudden you're getting attacked.
Yeah.
You know, even though we've got the China thing and, you know, Pelosi's in Taiwan at the moment.
A province of China, apparently.
Yes. The nation of Taiwan.
Oh, how dare you. No, I'm a fan of Taiwanese as a nation.
Yeah, very big fan.
Taiwanese fried chicken is so much better than Korean fried chicken.
I spent 2 weeks there at a conference one. I reckon it's great.
It's a great place.
Fantastic place. Yeah, very vibrant. So, but the occasions in which we, particularly, you know, since the Second World War, in which where's the physical threat to Australia? We all feel quite comfortable.
That's true.
We know intellectually there's a potential threat, you know, nuclear threat at some stage if things went completely wrong, but we'd be at the very tail end of all of that. So we feel very comfortable. We feel very safe. We can, you know, worry about our dogs and our cats and all those sorts of things, and our kids and all that sort of stuff, and the environment, and all those things that we've got time to contemplate.
Okay. Should ask you before you go, of course, about the Not Above the Law campaign, because people message me all the time saying what's going on with the court cases to hold the Daniel Andrews government to account for hotel quarantine.
The court case is again back in the hands of the judge, who's got papers before him over the meaning of the word matter, and the judge is contemplating in his chambers the positions that we've put to him and that the WorkSafe put to him. So essentially what we've got is the whole thing doing its slow legal process with the Work Cover Authority or WorkSafe playing technical legal games around in the interpretation of what the actual law says, and until all of that stuff gets resolved, we can't move.
So WorkSafe is playing technical legal games. What's your feel for them? Are they feeling strong, confident, desperate? Why are they doing this?
Because the whole thing is before the judge, I'm not going to express a view.
Until I turn the cameras off.
Yeah. Well, genuinely, you know, with any of these things, like I'm very familiar with legislation, and often, you know, you'll find that whether the word it or that has been used changes the whole paragraph, or whether you've got a comma or a full stop, you know, etc. So these things, you have to let them just play out literally, and it's not appropriate to make comment while the judge is considering, because you have to leave the judge to do it. We've made all the applications, so it's just rolling on, and these things take a long time with all of them. But we haven't stopped, I can tell everyone that much, and we're not stopping.
Will it be resolved before the election, in your estimation?
I would doubt it.
Oh, gee, okay.
Because I think that the WorkSafe Authority have probably got the capacity to keep doing more things to keep delaying.
Great.
To just understand here also that the prosecution of the health department, believe it or not, there's the charges sheet is supposed to be a public domain document, but you can't get it.
Right? Okay.
We did get a copy through FOI, but the entire thing was redacted, all blacked out.
Okay.
The whole thing, right? The next hearing for the prosecution of health, so the state election is the 26th of November. The next hearing for the prosecution of health is the 28th of November.
Yeah, why is this place so corrupt? I tell you what. Can I ask a question that's unrelated to your court case? Because someone's contacted me this week with evidence of corrupt judiciaries in Victoria. How seriously should I take that, given just historically speaking, your understanding of this state historically? Is that a far-out claim, or could it be plausible description.
Well, whatever people think of the Pell case, the George Pell case, for the George Pell case to have been thrown out so comprehensively by the High Court, 7-0, says a lot about the state of play of the judiciary in Victoria. This has not been, the Pell case was not isolated. It was one of a series of situations where decisions of the courts of Victoria were comprehensively thrown out.
So I should take such claims, as I investigate such claims submitted to me, I should take them as serious and potentially real, not just some conspiracy theory.
Well, here I'll give a very specific example. There was in the occupational health and safety area. People are held, and this is what we're doing with the Dan Andrews thing, people are held responsible for what they reasonably and practically control. There's a company called Baeda that was a chicken processing company. The unions hated them. They wouldn't allow the unions on site. The unions wanted to get rid of them. In actual fact, they've now left Victoria. They've been pushed out of Victoria. And Baeda is a private family company, but a big chicken processing company. So they were buying chickens from a chicken grower. They supplied the trailer for the truck that was picking up the chickens. Now, at the chicken grower place, they were loading chickens. They had the big pallets full of chickens. And someone who was not licensed to drive a forklift jumped on the forklift and went to load the truck. The pallets fell and killed someone. So the only connection between Baeda and the chicken grower was that the they'd supplied the trailer, and they were buying the chickens. Baeda was prosecuted. That was the only connection. Now, under any interpretation of the work safety laws in Australia, they were in no way even remotely connected to the death. They were prosecuted. They were convicted.
Oh, in Victoria.
In Victoria. The same situation of George Pell. Full bench of the Supreme Court convicted them. Went to the High Court and was thrown out at the High
Court.
Straight away.
What's wrong with the judiciary in Victoria? Is it unique in the
States? So when I'm saying the George Pell case, you know, George Pell was prosecuted, whatever you think of George Pell. George Pell was prosecuted for what he represented, not what he did.
Whether he did or not, I'm not sure, but yes.
According to the High Court, he didn't do it.
Oh, is that what they said?
Well, that was the whole case was thrown out.
I thought they threw out for a... No,
it wasn't a technical case. The whole thing, the whole prosecution was just a sham. And that it got that far.
But you're right, he was prosecuted for... He was the lightning rod for Catholic Church abuses over decades. And so
he was prosecuted for what he represented, not what he did. And it was found in the High Court that he was not guilty. So the long and short, he didn't do it. He was not guilty. And whatever you think of George Pell. But that was just one case. So there was this Baeda case. And there was a whole string of these sorts of things.
Is this unique amongst the states in Victoria?
Well, I think it's quite extraordinary. And it raises enormous concern for me.
But these kinds of appointments to the judiciary in Victoria, if that was the problem, they've been appointed by Dan Andrews types of people, goes back decades. They've been there for a long time. So it must be a cultural phenomenon within Victoria to produce legal decisions that are out of mainstream amongst Australia.
What the reasons are and all the rest, I won't comment. All you can do is look at the facts, that there's been a consistent process in Victoria with decisions being made in the courts which have been at the highest level where they've been thrown out by the High Court of Australia.
Quickly, unanimously.
And I don't think that there's a pattern like that in the other states. So what are the causes of that? You have to be pretty careful about any comments that you make about the judiciary.
This is why I'm concerned about these. Anyway, I'll figure out what to do with these allegations. Okay, and finally, you were on this channel a while ago saying that Daniel Andrews will lose the next election. That was the title that I made. I editorialized and put over the whole thing. But that was the point of our discussion, and you believed that. Has anything changed? Do you believe that will still be the case?
Well, I think I said that, and I still maintain that he can't win.
It'd be a minority, if anything.
He can't win, but can the Liberals win?
Why do you say he can't win? Same reasons? He's lost confidence with the outer suburbs.
Well, a number of things. You look at it it's a terribly brave person makes predictions about politics and elections, but, you know, I'll be silly enough to do it. He's garrotted so many people in the Labor Party that he's intensely hated.
Yeah, but they don't do anything about it, the Muppets.
Well, he's got enemies everywhere.
Yeah, but they don't do anything about it. Well, the only one is Somyuk. Even Kasha, all these people who get screwed by him, they just whimper in the corner.
He's got a whole series of scandals rolling out.
They're taking their bloody time.
They take an enormous amount of time, so they're all rolling out. There's all sorts of stuff coming out. It's a government that does have a smell of death about it, and you can see this with governments beforehand.
Can you imagine if you got another term? That would be fun, because it would be like a rotting corpse for three years. That would be amazing.
And must always remember, how governments go. So my sense is that I think the electorate will look, and you've got to remember 40% of people are swinging voters now.
It's huge.
Massive numbers don't make up their mind until the minute they've walked into the polling booth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so people turn around and go, you know what? The ones that are going to decide what happens.
Yeah.
He's been there, he's done a whole lot of stuff. I get what he did. I could see the good things that he's done, but there's just something here that makes me uncertain. I haven't got a viable opposition that I feel comfortable with. What am I going to do?
Teal, Greens, UAP, Freedom Parties, Victoria's Parties, minor parties.
So it'll probably, as I said, you're a stupid person to make comment and predictions about what's going to happen in an election. But that's my gut feel about the whole thing. And it's just the smell of corruption around that is just so strong.
What happens if he gets back in? That might be a more interesting question. What would happen then? What would that say to you if he gets in with a majority government reasonably well?
If he got into with a majority government reasonably well,
what does that tell you about Victoria?
Well, the United States starts to look pretty good, doesn't it?
Oh, it's quite a negative result.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't... You know, this is the same sort of situation. I saw this in New South Wales when the last Labor government got kicked out.
Yeah, that was.
And they were reduced. I don't know if that'll happen here, but they were reduced to all getting together in the telephone booth. But it was just rife corruption.
That was a bad government.
Oh boy, even. One of the ministers,
Eddie Obeid.
One of the other. He was outed as a pedophile, and he's in jail as a pedophile.
No way. And really?
He was having.
I didn't know that.
He was having boys in his ministerial office.
Oh, in the Labor ministry.
Yeah. and when he was outed by his electoral staff, by his woman in his electoral office, and he was outed, she was sacked. And put through the ringer as a whistleblower and all the rest, and she was proven to be completely correct.
Wow.
This was the level of it. And there's and what we saw in Queensland with the level of corruption in Queensland that evolved and all the rest.
What do you mean? In the...
Under JBL Capitis.
Oh, okay, that was a long time ago.
But in my generation, right?
But they're back in power now.
Sorry?
Anastasia's
romping in. But I see a level of corruption in Victoria that's way worse.
Than Bjelke Petersen?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Ooh.
Way worse. And it's culturally entrenched. The fact that, that what's going on with our police force is just appalling.
Oh, that's a joke. Even the CAA I've got an AGM on Saturday. They've all turned on Shane Patton. They were the biggest wag flavors for Shane Patton, and they've all said, "No, he's dodgy."
No, just. But Victoria, I think we've discussed it before. Victoria has a long history of corruption in the police force. Mm. You know, you go back to the Bertram Wainer period of the. Once again, I'm showing my age.
How long ago was this?
Oh, back in the 60s.
60s, okay.
Yeah, then, so when you had the abortion clinics.
Okay.
And Bertram Wainer was running an illegal Bertram abortion clinic, and he was a doctor.
Okay.
But he had to employ, and he was under an attack from the police and all the rest and all the gangs because he wasn't paying off the police.
Yeah.
And he had to employ private security because his life was seriously under threat.
Okay.
And
everyone keeps telling me that New South Wales police is more corrupt than Victorian police.
Oh, I wouldn't think so now. If I was drawing a line between the two.
Look, if we're having competitions over which police force is the most corrupt historically and currently, that's you got a problem, police forces. All right, what do you think of Albo? Because he's gone up in the polls, approval ratings since being elected. Despite all my free market leanings and so on, anti-socialist leanings, I quite like the guy for some reason. Maybe I'm hoodwinked. I don't feel any great threat coming from him, except for, I guess, some of the stuff you've talked about. But really, there's something about him that feels a bit...
comfortable.
Something about it. He's not a Bill Shorten figure. I'm not threatened by him. He's a teddy bear, if anything.
Well, I'm actually impressed.
You're impressed with Albert?
The immediate moves on the international scene, I think, have been incredibly important.
Okay.
They've consolidated what the Morrison government was doing on the security issues.
Yeah.
Even though the Chinese, if I rephrase it, the Communist Party of China, trying to sort of see if they can get a Keating type approach. That's not happening. The clear support for Ukraine.
He's been surprisingly good, hasn't he?
I think he's been impressive, and he's gone out there not in a noise making way, but just a very quiet. Gives an impression of he knows where he's going. So I think on the international sphere, I think it's been very impressive, and I think one of the most important things that goes down. Very important.
Well, what happened to all this talk about him being from the socialist left faction, so he's going to drag the country that way?
We've got that sort of stuff going, the agenda we've got here. But they're always... None of the political parties are one thing. They're a combination of forces.
Okay, yeah, because he's not a plebiscite, you know? He's not a... Yeah, anyway, that's enough praise for Albert.
And there's a long way to go.
Yes, I know. That's what I'm waiting for. Something. It just feels a bit vanilla at the moment. Like, it's fine. He seems cuddly and that's it. But that's neither good nor bad. It's just... Okay. Mm. Thank you for discussing this stuff. Hopefully...
I hope it wasn't too boring, but you know.
Well, I found it interesting. I don't know if anyone else did.
Yeah.
And we'll see you again, hopefully, on the People's Project. People love you on there.
Oh, right.
They love it when you talk about politics the way you think.
Oh, okay. That's good. Mm. Good. I hope I can... occasionally influence a politician to sort of do good things and stop bad things.
Sounds like that's what you've been doing for decades. All right, you can check out Ken at Self-Employed Australia. I'll put a link to his website below. And of course, if you've been watching our shows and you value what we do, you should be supporting us at Locals, discernible.locals.com. If you haven't seen my custard video, I did a video on how to make the best, most creamy custard you've ever seen, and it literally is, because commercially it's uncommercial. You can't make custard with those kinds of ingredients. So go and check that out on my channel, on my website, discernible.io, and make some lovely custard.